Welcome to The Rest of History, a new history podcast for a new audience. I'm Sam.
And I'm Lauren.
And today, Lauren is going to tell me about...
Mark! So mark that down on your calendar. That's what today's episode is about.
Oh, look at you. Already started, fresh out of the gates.
Woo! Have you been to Boston?
Sam? Yeah, I've been to Boston. Yeah, I'd say I like Boston.
I love Boston. I'm a secret masshole, and I'm aware that that used to be, like, a derogatory term, but, like, has been reclaimed.
Yeah.
And I should say, before Massachusetts comes to my
somebody
ass,
from
they have... They have already reclaimed it for themselves. But yes, I am from Iowa.
Yeah.
I'm kind of like that vine where, like, in all forms except physical,
I'm a wolf.
In all forms except physical, and I guess legal, because I don't vote there, I am a masshole. My dad, Doug, friend of the pod, Doug.
Friend of the pod, definitely.
Has worked in commercial real estate for decades, and he was assigned to the Northeast for quite some time, and so he would go to Boston every month for years. That man loves Boston. It is the only family vacation.
Maybe it's genetic.
It could be. It is the only family vacation where he has been like, Susan, friend of the pod, Susan is my mother. Susan plans nothing. This is Doug's trip, which is like... And it was delightful. I mean, if you like American history, you will like
Boston.
Oh,
I mean, the like, homeland the of homeland, American
the
history.
The cradle. I love the culture of Massachusetts. I love a Cruella. I love a Dunks. And listeners, you won't know this, but I've taken it upon myself to dress in costume for the recording session of this episode. And by dress in costume, I mean wear my Boston Red Sox hat. I am a Cubs fan. I did have a dog named Wrigley growing up. And yet the baseball hat that I wear more than any other is my Boston Red Sox hat. I won't lie to you, Sam. You often get on me about how my topics are maybe not the most uplifting in nature. Mark's might be the worst one yet.
Oh, great. I mean, to be fair, I have not given you the most lighthearted of stories. And I feel like as the season progresses and we choose new topics, I'm going to try and maybe bring in some fun. But that's not easy with history that has been relegated, right?
That's a damn fact. People don't like thinking about things that are upsetting.
Yeah, or things that they are responsible for.
Not a lot of people are talking about this, I don't know, they call it CRT? What is it? People have like a lot of thoughts about, you know, should we teach American history as it happened? And the people who are upset about that are like, no, don't point out that my grandfather owned slaves. That's mean. Motherfucker, he owned people.
Mm-hmm.
He owned people. That's mean, you dumb motherfucker.
Amen.
At Lindsey Graham. Come find me.
Don't even mention Lindsey Graham.
I fucking hate it.
I did share with Lauren what I have heard about Lindsey Graham, and it was viral on Twitter and TikTok at one point. Like,
and
semi-viral.
And it was vile.
Oh,
period.
It is one of the worst things I've ever heard in my life. Maybe an exaggeration, but it's honestly up there.
It's up there.
I mean, I wouldn't say, like, look it up and go to, like, images or anything.
Like, listeners, I'm saying this out of love for you. Don't.
Just, like, go on TikTok or Twitter and just type in, like, Lindsey Graham ladybugs.
Don't even say it.
Okay, I will say Lindsey Graham and his alleged ladybugs have to protect ourselves legally. I don't know if this is, like, true, but honestly, it's so unhinged I completely believe it.
Who would make that up?
I don't even know how you would begin to conceive of
Mm-mm.
this idea.
Mm-mm. Mm-mm. Yeah, this podcast is not about Lindsey Graham. So, Sam, I know you love Boston. I know I love...
Oh, wait, can I guess? I'm assuming we're talking about Boston. We've discussed it a little bit. The cradle of early American history.
Ooh.
So I'm assuming something early American history related.
You're damn right.
And that is the extent of my guess. Boston, what else would we talk about?
Personally, I would talk about Boston Rob, my all-time favorite Survivor contestant.
Okay, yeah, love that.
Stan Boston Rob.
That's good, I like it.
Boston Rob... DM me if you're ever in DC. I will take you anywhere you want to go. I will buy you a goddamn six course
you
meal.
And the Amber
I have so
Army.
Many questions. So one of the famed events in Boston in early America is the Midnight Ride of Paul Revere. You've heard of that.
Yeah.
What do you know about it? What's your kind of awareness of what happened? What's the circumstance?
Okay, so...
This is not a pop quiz. This is just like, I want
to
know
No, but
what
we can pretend it is.
Oh, I will be scoring you then.
Oh, okay. So let's see. For one, not an Americanist.
I literally knew you were going to say that. I almost said, to give Sam some credit, she's not an Americanist.
Yeah, and so, like, I definitely don't know the intricacies of Paul Revere.
That's good.
He rode a horse, rang a little bell, British are coming, British are coming.
He made pots for a living.
Okay, did not know that, but I'm here for it. Mm-hmm. I feel like there was also something else, like, you know, Midnight Ride kind of thing. Also involved a doctor of some sort. The book Mahogany.
That is Mahogany.
Mahogany, The Costs of Luxury in Early America by...
Jennifer L. Anderson.
Yes, Jennifer L. Anderson.
Published by Harvard University Press.
That's pretty much it.
I think what is very, very funny is...
Wait, well, you didn't tell me what my score was.
Pretty much, actually, 10 out of 10.
That's perfect.
All of that was correct.
Oh, like, American Revolution.
Yeah, good, good. Mm-hmm. Yes, very important.
Yes.
Yeah, his, if you ever are in Massachusetts, he has some very interesting woodwork in his house that's, like, original. And I believe actually a lot of it is mahogany. Yeah, he was pretty well established. He was doing good business. Like, he was...
Gotcha. He was so people knew his name. They're like, is this a Revere? And you're like, oh, of course it is.
Costos. Yeah, but he lives in the North End. Like, he was very of the town and lived very close to the Old North Church, which is, of course, another landmark in early American history. That is the church where somebody would hang one lantern in the steeple if the British were coming by land. They would hang two lanterns in the steeple if the British were coming by sea. And so, because the Old North Church is high up in terms of topography, and because the steeple is
the largest,
in terms of architecture, it is very visible. It can be seen like across the Charles River in Charlestown. That was part of this sort of intelligence and alarm system that Paul Revere helped kind of drum up, of basically
King.
Like men who were ready to like go tell it on the mountain that the British are coming. And that is exactly what happened. So in April 1775, Boston has had beef with the British forces for quite some time.
Oh yeah.
It's basically a fascist police state run by the Redcoats. Boston is not having it. As always, basically Massachusetts residents are just like, fuck you, this is my town, you can't take it from me.
And this is post-Boston Massacre
It sure is. I mean, literally the Boston Massacre started because people threw snowballs at British soldiers.
Oh, yeah.
Like, they were not fucking around. They did not like these people. And for good reason. These people were not nice to them. But it comes to the point in April 1775 where British forces are marching in quite large numbers to Lexington and Concord.
Mm-hmm. And I am familiar with those names.
Yes. And the thing about marching is that it takes time because you're not, like, running or riding. And so, because Paul Revere helped to set up this alarm system and, you know, had access to horses, the Massachusetts residents on this particular night are able to get to important people to notify them that the British are coming, the British are coming.
That's a good impression. Famed.
Oh, thank you. I've studied his dialect.
Yeah, have you been method acting? I see Revere in your eyes.
The British are coming. They're coming. Those fucking redcoats. They don't even drink donkeys. They fucking tax our tea. Now we gotta drink fucking dunks. Like,
Lauren's gonna tell us that Paul Revere was one of her past lives.
I mean, he was alive at the same time as Ernestine, so TBD. Was I living in two places at once? And I was just like so staunchly anti-British that I was like, I'll be Paul Revere and I'll be French, like with the monarchy.
You can't be more anti-British than French.
And the reason that Paul Revere's ride has persisted through popular history and school and history is kind of due to two main preservations of the tale. One is by Paul Revere himself, told years after the fact, which, if you are somebody who is interested in oral history, quite frankly, if it's been 25 years since something happened, even though people tell stories that they believe themselves to be true, you know, as time passes, details change, details are embellished. It's not necessarily the most factually accurate, but a first-person perspective, I mean, it's a primary source written after the fact. A primary and a half. 23 years after the Midnight Ride in 1798, Paul Revere has a request come in from the corresponding secretary of the Massachusetts Historical Society, and that corresponding secretary's name was Jeremy Belknap. He sent out a request to Paul Revere to kind of provide a recounting of his ride. So there had been initial versions written down in 1775, you know, immediately after the fact, but the 1798 version is much more detailed. It's much more extended. Paul Revere definitely had the sense that, like, his contributions were important and that they needed to be preserved for the future, and so it's much more inclusive.
Yeah, I mean, that, and it's 1798, like, it's all, at this time, it's all about forming a national identity, too.
Facts.
Which
early republic.
I would imagine why the secretary of the Historical Society sees it so important to find this information about, like, the formation of the republic and whatnot.
Most def. Yeah, at this point, it's like, America's gonna be a real country. Like, we actually have made it 22 years at this point. We've made it almost a generation into the United States, and they were like, when our children tell our story, they'll tell the story of tonight.
I love the Louis Armstrong Hail
to. Yeah. I was kind of going to go collab for Lin-Manuel at first, but then I was like, I can't really do that because
there's only one person who can do it.
That one guy on TikTok.
Yeah.
Lin-Manuel. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
So his account really, it really demonstrates, it was very important that this happened. It was also low-key extremely dangerous and risky. It wasn't just like, they've set up the system and he was like, ready to run. Like, he straight up was captured by British forces at one point. The other major recounting of Paul Revere's Midnight Ride that was very specifically preserved was Henry Wadsworth Longfellow's dramatic epic poem, Paul Revere's Ride.
Girl, that name
brings you there.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, yes. Do you know the actual original title of that poem?
Paul Revere's, I don't know. I mean, I can guess.
You won't get it.
Big man, little horse, gets the British, something like that. That's my guess.
Paul Revere's Ride was written in 1860. It was first published in 1861.
So quite some time.
Yes.
After.
It was later retitled The Landlord's Tale in 1863. And that is because it's written from the perspective of the landlord of the Wayside Inn, which is along the road that that Paul Revere rode upon. So Henry Wadsworth Longfellow, interestingly, had a connection to the actual historical Paul Revere. His maternal grandfather, Peleg Wadsworth, that is P-E...
I'm sorry. I literally thought you said peg leg.
It's peg leg without the first G.
Okay. So Peleg, yes.
Peleg.
Uh-huh. I kind of love it.
I know. So Peleg Wadsworth, I'm going to name my son Peleg.
Yes.
Was Revere's commander
on the Penobscot Expedition, which was an event of the Revolutionary War where there was essentially an armada that sailed from Massachusetts up to the Penobscot Bay. And that event was, I mean, just largely a complete disaster.
So he has this personal connection.
Yes, he's got
a real connection. 90 years later, he's like, you want what I'm gonna do? Write this little ditty.
It's actually very interesting with the time that he did write this.
I was gonna say, this is like Civil War, right?
I got you. So Longfellow, like his relatives, and this is Longfellow of like Hiawatha fame, like same dude.
Gotcha, okay.
He was inspired to write this poem after visiting the Old North Church in Boston, and he climbed its tower on April 5th, 1860, which was...
I'm sorry, I just imagined like a little King Kong situation.
The episode image, in case anybody was wondering, is Sam's cat Darcy, Godzilla King Konging the Old North Church. So he visited 85 years, almost to the day. He begins writing the poem the next day. It was first published in the January 1861 issue of the Atlantic Monthly. January 1861 is literally just as South Carolina secedes from the Union. Really awkward time. And it was part of a series of a bunch of narratives published as a little collection. It's kind of Canterbury Tales-esque.
That's the vibe that I got.
Which is why like it's called The Landlord's Tale. Like, it's in its little collection. It's called Tales of a Wayside Inn. It's the same shit as Canterbury
Tales. Of course, this is also like the Romantic era, right?
Absolutely.
So of course everybody is making all these allusions
romanticizing everything.
To medieval literature and whatnot.
And actually, very interestingly, Henry Wadsworth Longfellow also has a close personal connection with somebody else who is very, very well known when it comes to talking about antebellum America. And that would be Charles Sumner.
Oh.
As in the man who got his ass beat on the Senate floor. Yeah, caned. He got his, like, I really don't even...
He went blind or something, right?
We tell this story in, like this makes it into a push, is, like, Charles Sumner straight up was brutally attacked. Charles Sumner was the senator, one of the senators from Massachusetts. So he was a very powerful anti-slavery force, leader of the radical Republicans. Preston Brooks literally almost beat him to death with a cane on the Senate floor after Sumner was giving his anti-slavery speech. That gets told in history class as like a funny adage. It is like the least funny thing in the world to me to think about.
Oh, I completely agree.
The Senate floor being a place where somebody can beat the shit out of their... Look, I hate Lindsey Graham as much as the next bitch. And like Lindsey Graham is like a direct antecedent like of Preston Brooks.
Oh yeah.
Like, I fucking hate that shit.
In general, some stories are just taught that way, and I'm not surprised. Like, I have definitely heard about other people discussing it like this. I mean, yeah, I remember discussing it in A Push and just being horrified, right? But I think the way that my teacher used it as well was talking about, like, just using it to discuss how batshit crazy everything was becoming.
Absolutely. I say that as though Charles Sumner is, you know, perfectly innocent in doing this.
Oh, no.
In his speech, which is called the Crime Against Kansas, look, I'm not saying he deserved it, because he didn't. Nobody deserves to have the, like, to fucking be beaten with a stick.
Yeah, nobody deserves to be assaulted.
At work. Yeah. Like, where is Senate HR? Call me up. However, I can understand why Preston Brooks was incensed, because in the speech, Sumner went after his first cousin once removed, Andrew Butler, referring to him as a pimp for slavery, and then mocking, oh, it gets worse, he mocked that Butler had a stroke and had a subsequent speech impediment, and then also just made other insults meant to kind of degrade people's opinions of Butler's character, his loyalty to the United States, his intelligence.
Gotcha.
So, like, don't do that. You don't do that.
Okay,
you
well, here's the thing.
You should not have the shit beaten out of you at work, but literally, Charles Sumner is so injured that it was multiple years before he could return to the Senate, and Massachusetts was like, this is the most Massachusetts thing that's ever happened. They did not hold an election to replace him. They left his desk empty in the Senate to remind everybody of the time that he got, like, that somebody fucking assaulted him on the Senate floor.
I was totally there with the whole pimp for slavery thing. Like, get him.
Deserves
get
that.
Get him.
Deserves that. That's valid.
The stroke and speech impediment. That's kind of pushing it.
We don't do that.
Yeah.
Well, we do that if we're Donald Trump, because he mocked a reporter with a speech impediment.
We do that if we're, like, not good people.
Yeah. If you're mocking people because of the speech impediment, which, quite frankly, they have no control over, go fuck yourself and you may quote me on that.
100%. But yeah, of course, nobody deserves to be, like, assaulted.
No. Yeah. We don't condone that form of violence. I don't do that. He had, like, headaches, nightmares, essentially PTSD.
Yeah, I mean, so would I. Like, if I got my shit rocked randomly, completely unprompted, in a location where I would assume that would never happen.
Right.
Yeah, I would not be mentally okay.
He also tried to, like, go back to the Senate the following year. He was literally unable to get through one day. His doctor was like, you need to, like, GTFO.
Yeah, like, it's not worth it.
Go convalesce. Like, he went to Europe. He, like, went to Paris and was like, let me lay about. Which, like, antebellum America, I go to Paris too.
Yeah,
like,
yeah, yeah.
How about it? But yeah, he had, like, fucking spinal cord damage. Like, it was not... Yeah, it took him 3 years to get back to the Senate.
Wow.
So, fuck you, Preston Brooks, and you may quote me on
and
that.
And Lindsey Graham.
Yeah, if you're a senator from South Carolina...
Who's their other senator right now? Is it Tim Scott? It's Tim Scott, right?
I think so.
Ugh, if you're Tim Scott or Lindsey Graham...
I hate you both. I don't vibe with that shit. So it's published in January 1861. So literally South Carolina has just seceded from the Union. The poem is basically meant to kind of appeal to early Americana. It is 300% romanticism. Longfellow is very much somebody who would use poetry to kind of reinforce morality and culture. And that's something that he did with Charles Sumner too. So they were best friends, like lifelong best friends. And they actually used to publish together this publication called The Politics and Poetry of New England. Charles Sumner wrote all the politics. Longfellow wrote all the poetry. It was just like the two of them being besties, like very much, it was like a Key and Peele situation, like a, they were
playing to each other's strengths.
They were doing the damn thing. Yes, absolutely. It's very timely. Longfellow is reminding his readers that there is danger coming. The British are coming, the South and secession and the dissolution of the Union. People need to wake the fuck up. Listen, realize what's going on.
Yeah, ring a ding ding.
Do something about it. Hang your own damn lantern. Like,
I mean, it's meant to be provocative.
Tense moment. Yeah. Yeah. So this is the poem that starts, listen, my children, and you shall hear of the midnight ride of Paul Revere on the 18th of April in 75. Hardly a man is now alive who remembers that famous day and year. And it depicts how Paul Revere tells his friend, if the British come by land or if they come by sea, hang the lantern in the steeple, and I will go to the opposite shore, crosses the Charles River to Charlestown, gets his horse, and rides. And the reason he's doing this, in part, is to alert colonists that the British are coming. So, like, you know, stand guard, get your pitchforks, gird your loins, hide your women and children, hide your wife, because the British are redcoating everyone around here. He's also going to notify John Hancock and Samuel Adams that the British are going to try to arrest them. So, you know, timely. Paul Revere is depicted as riding across Massachusetts, and so he's left the village and mounted the steep, and it was 12 by the village clock when he crossed the bridge into Medford Town, or if you're from Massachusetts, Meffa. It's 1 by the village clock when he galloped into Lexington. It was 2 by the village clock when he came to the bridge in Concord Town. you know the rest, that's literally a line. So that's you know, Longfellow pushing this morality, he's pushing this narrative that Paul Revere himself,
yeah,
revolution,
was a bad bitch.
Yeah, baddie. He's really pushing this, like, Paul Revere is the man, we have to remember this. It's very important and timely that you guys, you know, think about people that were brave and you know, stood their guard and were prepared when enemy forces were about. What people are often surprised to learn about is that other people rode that night, among them William Dawes. There are a lot of maps, and we'll put one of these in the show notes, that show, you know, the Dawes route, the Revere route. In 1896, there's a little parody written by Helen F. Moore that is like, you fucking left out William Dawes. She writes, "'Tis all very well for the children to hear of the midnight ride of Paul Revere, but why should my name be quite forgot, who rode as boldly, and, well, God, what?" That's what, W-O-T. "Why should I ask? The reason is clear. My name was Dawes and his Revere." Which is like fucking slam poetry,
yeah,
like, let's
Shakespeare
go
vibes.
Of 1896. Like, but why I bring that up is there are other people who were accounted for in the immediate tellings that have not since been remembered. Yes, William Dawes also rode the horse, but there's somebody else that I think is a really interesting addition to this narrative that we should include. And that's why I bring up Mark for us today.
Ah, yes, back to Mark.
Yes. A lot of people like to kind of imagine the North, specifically New England, as, you know, they abolished slavery well before the Civil War. They didn't need to be told to by the Emancipation Proclamation. Like, they figured it out themselves.
I mean, yeah, that's like classic. You hear that all the time, where the North can't be racist because the South is racist, mm-hmm. as if, you know...
As if it was a competition.
Yeah, one, as if it's a competition. Two, as if, you know, racism ends with slavery.
Just because slavery ends doesn't mean that the economic prospects improve for
black people. Oh, of course, yeah.
Right. And so what I think is really interesting is that in Revere's 1798 account, he actually mentions slavery very briefly. What he brings up kind of illuminates a couple of things. So Paul Revere was not explicitly political. He's more poetic, you know, much of the Longfellow strain there. He doesn't have a lot of, like, recordings of, you know, his specific thoughts on slavery. He's more of like, I want the redcoats out of my neighborhood. I want to be free to get a cannoli at any hour of the day. I don't want to look at those fucking ugly redcoats. I'd throw a snowball at all of them, etc. But Paul Revere was not really celebrated for that mission while he was alive. It really becomes more sensationalized and more remembered as history pushes on. And of course, Longfellow is massive in that. But Mark doesn't make the edit. Mark is not in that poem in any regard. But Mark is actually incredibly well known in Boston at the time. And so while modern audiences might be like, where does slavery factor into the Midnight Ride? I thought we were just talking about this, like, big white man on his big old horse riding to
big
go...
white man on little horse, excuse you.
Excuse me, yes, right, little horse, going to go tell other white men that the British are coming and that they should, you know, get all the cannons and all the guns and protect Lexington and Concord, etc. But Paul Revere can be pretty sure that, as he tells Jeremy Belknap, the corresponding secretary of the Massachusetts Historical Society, that Jeremy and anybody who'd be reading this account, they would totally know who Mark was.
Okay.
So who is Mark, you ask? As he brings up Mark, it actually kind of demonstrates... Well, you've noticed that I haven't referred to Mark with a last name.
No, you have not. It has strictly been Mark.
Mark. And that is because Mark is sometimes referred to as Mark Codman. Codman is the last name of the man who enslaved Mark, John Codman. Mark was an enslaved man living in Massachusetts. And frankly, I just don't think that Codman is super relevant to this. Like,
oh, totally, yeah.
Yeah, no, Mark's Mark. Mark is Mark without Codman. Like, Mark has his own inherent humanity, and I just don't think John is relevant to his name. So I'm just going to refer to him as Mark. Mark was an enslaved man. He was charged with petty treason because he was involved in poisoning his enslaver, yes. Which is the definition of fuck around and find out, and I'll tell you why.
That is an intense anxiety felt by enslavers throughout the United States at that time, right?
Which, yeah, fuck around and find out.
Yeah.
Treat people like shit and find out what they're gonna do to you.
Because, like, anxieties of slave rebellions in general, but poisonings was definitely a big cultural anxiety. Like, people were terrified of this happening.
When the news hit around the world that the Haitian Revolution happened...
Oh, yeah.
White men everywhere freaked the fuck out because they genuinely believed that, like, if it
could
happen in Haiti... They were next, absolutely. And granted, Haiti had, you know, demographically speaking, they had far more enslaved people than enslavers. And so part of that, the success of the Haitian Revolution is the number game.
Yeah, definitely like a different context.
For sure.
But people, you know, saw themselves as the equivalent to what was happening.
Yes. And so white men everywhere were like, they're coming for me.
Yeah, because people had this fear, and then the Haitian Revolution happened.
And then they were like, oh my god,
this isn't just like an irrational fear that we have. It is truly something that can happen. Fear. Yeah.
Yes. And so John Codman was a retired ship captain. He had at least three people that he enslaved, Mark, and then two women, Phyllis and Phoebe. It's unknown when Mark was first enslaved by Codman, but there are records that show that he at least lived with him by the 1740s at some time. John Codman lived in Charlestown, across the river from Boston. Mark, however, was allowed to live in Boston with his wife and his child, as long as he hired himself out for work, which means that he was allowed to work for individuals who were not John Codman, but John Codman would be given all of the wages.
Gotcha.
Which is some fucking bullshit.
Oh, of course, yeah.
That was very common. That was allowed. Terrible. But in 1748, Boston city officials, quote, warned out, unquote, Mark. And that just means that he was forced to return to Charlestown without his family.
Okay.
So Mark has been wronged multiple times at this point.
Do we know why that happened?
I don't know. I'm guessing it's something to do with property laws.
Makes sense.
So around that same time, John Codman, the devil, sold one of Mark's children to another slave owner. And so he separated the family further.
Dear God.
That is
not uncommon, again.
Not uncommon, but
it doesn't make it any less horrible.
Terrible. Mark, being an excellent father, asked Codman if he could be sold that new owner. Codman refused. It's also possible, we're not positive, that Mark asked for his freedom, but knew that that was extremely unlikely, like more so unlikely than the sale, because at that time, enslavers had to pay a 50-pound bond for each enslaved person that they freed.
Oh.
Uh-huh.
Why?
Racism.
Well, yeah.
Genuinely, I'm unaware of why the fuck that law existed, and that 50 pounds is a lot of money, because the average person makes about 40 pounds a year. So that's like over a year's wages to
an ordinary
grant,
yeah,
your, I can't even say employee, but grant the person that does labor for you for free their freedom. Mm-hmm. So that's a choice that John Codman, being the fucking devil, is not going to make. Mark is not satisfied, of course.
Yeah.
So Mark makes an initial attempt to self-liberate. It escalates slightly. So 1749, Mark and some other people who were enslaved by Codman burned down Codman's blacksmith shop and workhouse, hoping that that cost, you know, the cost of that destruction would force him to
sell
Mark to another owner.
Gotcha.
To another enslaver.
Gotcha.
That plan failed, unfortunately, but violence continues from both sides. So Mark and other enslaved people, they don't let up. They're still persisting, hoping to liberate themselves. Codman is still a fucking professional douchebag.
Yeah, not to project any emotion onto Mark, because we don't necessarily know what he was feeling, but I imagine it wasn't great. I imagine Mark was struck with grief, and, you know, the desperation behind what you're describing, I think, speaks volumes.
Yeah. So, there's demonstrated records that John Codman is extremely violent towards the people he enslaves. In 1752, he struck a man that he had enslaved named Tom and injured his eyes. One of his eyes never healed. We know this because Phoebe had to dress Tom's eye, you know, take care of it and heal. Tom had sought revenge, apparently, according to Mark's testimony, because he hoped that Codman would, quote, never get up again for his eyes' sake, unquote.
Fair.
Deserved.
Yeah.
Deserved. So, eventually, this conflict takes a turn towards fatality, because the people who were held in bondage by John Codman decided they had fucking had enough.
Like, all of them?
Well, enough of them. But
okay.
They plotted his murder.
Yeah, like a little rebellion.
Yes. There are trial records because Mark, Phyllis, and Phoebe all had to give testimony. They were all involved in the murder. Phyllis, for her part, obtained the actual poison. She did not put it in Codman's food. But Phoebe put in a, quote, white powder into Codman's chocolate and his water gruel, which I assume is oatmeal, perhaps? Water and gruel? I'm gonna call it oatmeal grits, perhaps?
Yeah.
Some sort of starch and water. Phyllis also notes that she tried to put some of the poison into his drink. He was drinking a barley drink. Sounds disgusting. then she immediately, quote, felt ugly. And so she poured out the water and replaced it with clean water. It actually seems that it took about a week for Codman to feel the effects of the poison.
Do we know what it was? White
Some
powder,
sources
like
say
arsenic.
Some sources say arsenic. All that, you say, you know, Phyllis bought the poison, Phoebe put it in the food. How is Mark involved? So Phyllis's testimony makes it clear that Mark was the person who came up with the plot. Mark could read, which was uncommon at that time for someone able to read. Mark had read a portion of the Bible that said, it was no sin to kill him if they did not lay violent hands on him. You can actually read the original trial notes, and we'll put a PDF in our show notes as well. Mark had come up with this poison and said the reason that they wanted the poison was to kill some of the pigs on the property, which I guess was a humane way to kill pigs. So Phyllis had gotten the original dose of poison. Mark went by ferry back to Boston and got more poison from an enslaved person named Robin. He also made a dig at Phyllis, telling her that she was, quote, a damned fool, unquote, for not giving Codman enough poison the first time, because then it would have killed him right away and nobody would have known what had killed him. And Phyllis asked Mark, like, how the fuck do you know that? And he explains,
dude, use all of it.
Mark explains that he knows that, quote, Mr. Salmon's Negroes, unquote, had poisoned their master and were never caught. Phyllis and Phoebe said they were initially opposed, but once Codman forced Mark to leave his wife in Boston and return to Charlestown, she and Phoebe changed their minds. They were like, this is some fucking bullshit. So she implicates Mark as the instigator, but essentially is like,
also like indicts herself.
I was the executor. I got the poison. Phoebe poisoned Codman.
And we all had a hand in it, kind of thing.
Yeah. Yeah. We both reached for the gun if you're a Chicago fan. So Phyllis and Mark pled not guilty because they did not put the poison in the food.
Yeah.
Jury didn't care. Jury brought down a guilty verdict.
I mean, why would they?
Yeah.
I mean, with like racism and whatnot.
Mm-hmm. Well, also like who's a citizen at this time? Who has the status to even be on a jury?
Oh yeah. White landowners,
mm-hmm.
British men.
How about that? So Phyllis and Mark plead not guilty. They are convicted. Phyllis gets a harsher sentence than Mark. She was ordered to be burned to death.
Oh, Jesus Christ, Lauren.
Mm-hmm. Mark is ordered to be hanged.
And wait, so what happened to Phoebe? Because I assume because Phoebe was the one who actually poisoned? Yeah, I would assume that her punishment would be just as harsh as Phyllis's. I would think.
One would think. I actually do know what happened to Phoebe.
Oh, yay!
It's better than we think.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
So all three of them were charged with petty treason. They were actually charged with petite treason, as in French, but that's what it was called at the time. And that's because it was the crime of killing a master.
Okay.
They added it to his meals 7 times.
Oh my
god.
Seven times? Holy shit.
It took a week for him to die. So, I mean, hardy immune system, I guess? They are all found guilty. They suffered different fates. So Phyllis was elderly. She was found guilty of both murder of an owner and petite treason. I don't understand how those are different, but murder and murder of an owner, I guess.
Okay.
She was burned at the stake in Cambridge at Gallows Hill, which is nearby if you've been to Cambridge, Porter Square. Phoebe was actually found to be a lesser conspirator, and so she was transported to a plantation in the West Indies. Still a terrible punishment.
Ooh.
But she technically was a lesser conspirator.
Gotcha. I mean, West Indies plantations do not... I doubt that they had good reputations then. I wonder, do you think it has anything to do with the fact that Phoebe also said, you know, she put it in his drink, but it made her feel ugly, so they're like, wow, this girl, morals?
Guess so. I mean, you have to remember that Massachusetts Bay Colony is essentially, like, founded on Puritan ideals of, you know, a Christian utopia. That's Plymouth, that's Salem. Like, these people love good. Mark is sentenced to be hanged. So Mark was 30 at the time. He was found guilty of the 2 crimes. He was hanged, also at Gallows Hill. Then his body was tarred and gibbeted. Are you familiar with what a gibbet is?
Are those that, like, not Iron Maiden kind of things, but, like, you know, the iron cage, maybe?
It's
kind of shaped like a person?
Yes, exactly. For listeners, kind of picture a human-sized bird cage without a floor. So hung in that chained cage for everybody to see.
Okay.
They just really felt that they would make an example.
Gotcha.
And so they did. And by that, I mean, they gibbeted his body. They hung it up in that chained cage. They kept it there. When Paul Revere rode in 1775, the gibbet and Mark's remains were still there.
Shut the fuck up. That's insane. You said like 20 years, right?
Mm-hmm.
That makes me like genuinely nauseous.
It's disgusting.
Yeah.
It's disgusting. I mean, imagine that happening today. First of all,
like, I don't want to.
No, I know, but, like, the death penalty is still a punishment in America. It's generally done in, you know, like fucking federal prison. It's not a public event. It's not a spectacle. Mm-hmm. It's not glamorous. I'm staunchly anti-death penalty, but that's neither here nor there for this episode. But I mean, imagine that happening today. Is you can go in public, watch somebody be executed by the state, watch their body, watch their corpse be tarred, then watch it be hung up in a human cage, and then it's still there 20 years later. Imagine you get married, have children, you know, have a career, and like your children become adults and it's still there.
That's so vile.
It's vile. It's absolutely correct. And this is in a Christian utopia where, you know,
yeah, okay.
Where exactly. The morality and an appeal to God is so palpable and part of everyday life. That's what these people are doing. So quite frankly, you know, the North is not immune from, but we abolished slavery before the war. Shut the fuck up. You are not innocent in this. Your hands are covered in tar and blood, and it's disgusting. But because Mark's body hung there for decades, it became a landmark. So Paul Revere rode past it, but he also knew that when he would be telling this tale to Jeremy Belknap, people would know what he was talking about when he rode past Mark.
I imagine in general, like, it's just gruesome. Mm-hmm. Even for people back then, seeing a hanging body every day, I would imagine that Mark, for one, leaves a physical transformation of the landscape, right? So people are walking by, and in one aspect, the landscape's just different. Now you have a physical marker of something. And two, it's just traumatizing to walk by and see, like, a fucking body hanging up for 20 years.
It's disturbing.
So, like, I would imagine some sort of emotional response is also elicited as well, so...
Yeah.
It's yucky.
So, I mean, like, where Mark's body is, was, it's on a public road. Like, a place where people travel, it's a landmark.
They wanted people to see him,
yes.
Too.
Yes. And this is written by Nina Rodwin, who is an interpreter at the Paul Revere House. She writes, and I think this is so poignant, "As the revolution began, Mark's body was a highly visible reminder that enslaved people in Boston did not have the same chances at freedom and the pursuit of happiness. In addition, they were under the constant fear that they could be captured and forced into enslavement in a different state. In reflecting on Revere's ride, we also remember and memorialize Mark Codman and all the other enslaved men and women who lived in Boston. In part, thanks to Paul Revere's legacy and the small notation he made in reflection on his famous ride, Mark's life and death will not be forgotten." And so the mention that Revere makes, he uses the execution spot as a reference point. So, quote, "After I passed Charlestown Neck and got nearly opposite where Mark was hung in chains, I saw two men on horseback under a tree," unquote. So he's referencing that enslavement is normal in colonial Massachusetts. Mark's decomposing body.
Still there.
It's a reference point. But it's just that. It's just a reference point. It's very
matter
objective,
of fact. Yeah.
Yes. The way that Revere mentions Mark. So
it's like, yeah, pass by that big old tree, yeah. You know. Oh yeah, by the way, pass by Mark.
Yeah. Tipped my tri-corner to Mark. Yeah. Paul Revere was 21 when Mark was executed, so he was in his 40s when he made his ride. Had lived in colonial Massachusetts all his life, where slavery was totally normal. Revere did not enslave people, but his grandmother, Deborah Hitchborn, had enslaved a man named Nolgar. Interesting name. It indicates that when she died, Nolgar was willed to Revere's uncle, Thomas. Revere was 8 when his grandmother died, so it's possible that he even, you know, had memories of Nolgar.
I'm sure he had memories of enslaved people in the colony in general, too.
Sure.
Just, like, day-to-day life. You said he was a silversmith.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, just, like...
He also lived as a child nearby Dr. Clark's wharf and would have known
Robin,
who was the enslaved man and co-conspirator who provided the poison to Mark, Phoebe, and Phyllis.
And also just, like, in general, living near any body of water at
Absolutely.
This time. Like,
Absolutely.
It's major ports. I mean, for one, you have new enslaved people coming in.
Mm-hmm.
You have enslaved people leaving to go to the West Indies. major place to exchange information in general. So I imagine living by a body of water would also give you insight into just like the trading of the Atlantic world, which included bodies.
And so there's a historians estimate that between 1755 and 1764, the slave population in Massachusetts was approximately 2.2% of the total population, but it was generally concentrated in industrial and coastal towns, both of which Boston is. And there are a lot of laws being passed regarding marriage, regarding movement about slaves during the colonial era, and even in the Massachusetts Constitution. The Massachusetts Constitution that was proposed in 1778 would have recognized slavery as a legal institution and excluded free African Americans from voting. That was not passed. The Constitution of Massachusetts of 1780, in contrast, contained a declaration that, quote, all men are born free and equal and have the right of enjoying and defending their lives and liberties. And actually, because of that Massachusetts Constitution, starting in 1780, enslaved people were able to sue their masters, their enslavers, for their freedom.
Oh.
And so they were considered both property and people, as you know, by the law. So they actually could institute and prosecute their own lawsuits. And by 1780, almost 30 slaves had sued for their freedom.
Good for them.
Mm-hmm. Which is great. Sucks that it's even
existed. I was right about to say, like, just in general, the fact that they would have to do that.
Right. Slavery is something that's being discussed, legislated. It's very much part of society. It's very much part of society in Boston. Revere, even though it's not clear exactly what his thoughts were, there's a letter from Thomas Wadsworth to Paul Revere that's kind of a suggestion that Paul Revere was personally anti-slavery, but we don't have a preservation of specific thoughts on slavery as an institution. And Paul Revere dies in 1818. At that point, there are over 10 states that have officially outlawed slavery, but it's almost 50 years later that slavery has ended in the U.S.
It's becoming, I don't want to say more of a hot topic, mm-hmm. but people are less concerned, obviously, with the American independence issue.
Right.
And so I would assume that more of their attention is being dedicated to issues of slavery.
Yes. So once we have a country, we decide maybe we should govern some stuff in it. In the early 19th century, the Atlantic slave trade is looking, it's seeing a lot of changes. And part of this is, you know, the Enlightenment and the rights of man, lots of just movements towards revolution and independence and the rights of the individual. And also just some people finally fucking figure out that the enslaved people are people. They deserve to fucking, you know, have rights.
So in 1807, that was the Slave Trade Act, where Britain outlawed the slave trade, basically. Mm-hmm. Had yet to, at this point, free their slaves, but this is a major Atlantic power signaling that they are done with the slave trade. That has resounding effects throughout the early American Republic, for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I mean, there was a Slave Trade Act in the United States, multiple. In fact, 1794 is American ships can't engage the trade. That's President George Washington. They were working on it. It wasn't great. 1800, they raised the value of the fines, so clearly people are still doing it. They were just like, it'll be not a crime if you're rich enough to pay for it, but we're gonna make that harder. In 1807, it's federally outlawed to import slaves into the United States.
Well, because the thing with the fines is, you make a good point where really you're only punishing
people that can't afford to pay the fine.
Yeah, but with that, if you are bringing in a whole boat full of people, if the fine isn't large enough for people to like not be able to make a profit on it, what is that doing?
Not a damn
thing. It's not mitigating like anything.
Yeah. Fun fact, I would love to know what congressman was responsible for writing this piece of legislation, but that 1800 act where they raised the fines, they awarded the informants the entire value of any ship seized.
Oh, wow.
Which is
so they wanted it done, basically. Yeah.
They were like, hey, if you snitch and you know that the ship is bringing in people to work as enslaved people, you win the value of the ship.
Oh,
motherfucker,
wow.
That's a reward I'm going after. I'm sitting in the ports with my fucking binoculars.
Just speculation, but I would imagine, like, I'm a little sailor.
Mm-hmm.
My captain wants to bring people over. Let's not even discuss my own political beliefs on the subject, but reporting my captain would probably set me up for life. Mm-hmm. I wonder how many people actually ended up acting on it. Mm.
We know that Providence, Rhode Island merchant John Brown was prosecuted. Sucks to suck, man.
Yeah, I mean, slave trade continued.
That's
for sure.
On you. He lost his case. He was forced to forfeit the ship in accordance with the law. He had gone to Africa and then gone to Cuba with over 200 slaves on board in 1796. Baby cakes. You know you're not supposed to do that. He had been fined earlier in 1796, £200, which, again, is about 4 years of the average person's wages. But at that point, Rhode Island had already outlawed slavery. He did it anyway, and then he was forced to forfeit his ship. So, good riddance, John Brown, go fuck yourself. Also, his ship captain, it notes, was also named Peleg.
Is this just, like, a popular... Is this the Emma of the 18th century?
Peleg, as a boy's name, originates in Hebrew. Peleg means division.
Listen, it's a sick name. I'm not arguing anything. This is just not the name I would expect to appear twice. It's very much giving, if I had a nickel for every time I heard Peleg today, I'd have two nickels, which isn't a lot, but it's weird that it happened twice.
Mm-hmm. So why is Mark left out of this narrative? Mark was preserved by Paul Revere. Paul Revere, essentially, is one of the reasons why I've heard about this story. I mean, he was introduced to me as a landmark on Paul Revere's
guide. God, that's so gross.
And then I was, you know, informed of the whole story of who Mark was. He's emblematic of colonial Massachusetts and the slave trade at that time. The North tries to kind of illuminate themselves as a moral and upright society as compared to the plantation South when it comes to slavery. The North just kind of tries to shirk all of the blame. The North is very much guilty here. And I think it's important that we bring up these stories of people that have been kind of erased throughout time. And Longfellow's poem, not to dunk on Henry Wadsworth Longfellow, but I'ma do it. He knows his poem is not historically accurate. He doesn't include William Dawes. He just focuses on Paul Revere. Some of the details are, you know, touchy at best.
But hagiographical, probably, mm-hmm. Yeah.
He actually claims that his mistakes were deliberate.
okay, King. Uh-huh, me yeah. too.
he had researched the event, he says, but that he manipulated the facts for poetic effect. Yeah. He was trying to create American legends, which he also did with the Song
of Hiawatha. Truly hagiographical.
Absolutely.
Then. Yeah.
He's trying to do that. You know, he does that in Song of Hiawatha. He does that in Courtship of Miles Standish, who was the governor of Plymouth. He's doing that because he's trying to write these great American legends. I mean,
I just can't Greece believe he has, really said, yeah, I meant to do
I
that.
I did it on purpose. You know, Greece has these Homerian epics. England has St. Crispin's Day. People have these rallying cries. And Longfellow sees it as his burden in this life to create these epics for this early American Republic. And especially in this antebellum time, there is this public, you know, desire for something that's unifying. And even though, you know, as many white men have done throughout history and continue to do, he embellishes the fuck out of a story for his own personal gain, he did accomplish that point. And I also want to say, while we're on the topic of people I hate who do wrong to other people, as I told you, this poem was once retitled The Landlord's Tale. I would like to say, fuck you to all landlords out there. You guys are crooks. You make your living by charging other people to live in buildings you own. And you require us to pay rent, and then you raise the rent, and that's your income. Fuck you, landlords. A-lab, if you will. All landlords are bastards.
Going back to what this did for the American consciousness at the time it was written, I would also imagine that, you know, this is a really anxiety-fueled time. People are freaked out and scared, like we've established that. So I would also imagine that it's way easier to look back on the past than it is to dedicate time to thinking about the future, right? An unknown, uncertain future. Meanwhile, we can talk about Paul Revere and all the cool things he did and be content with that. Do we know where Mark was, like now?
Yes, I have a picture and I'll put it in the show notes. It's in a very public location now. Like it's a public road. It's in the midst of Charlestown.
Do we know where Longfellow was from? Not to shoot so many questions at you. Okay.
The Wadsworth and Longfellow families are like New England elite. Actually, I should mention too, Longfellow was actually born when Maine was still part of Massachusetts.
Oh,
yeah,
okay.
So Massachusetts Bay Colony included what is modern day Maine. You could be from Portland and you're from Massachusetts. And Longfellow was born in Portland, Maine, but that was at the time Massachusetts. Peleg Wadsworth of grandfather fame was a general. In the war, a member of Congress. Henry Wadsworth Longfellow's mother was descended from a passenger on the Mayflower. He was named after his mother's brother, Henry, who was a Navy lieutenant who had died 3 years earlier at the Battle of Tripoli.
So, like, American-American?
American. Yeah, he's...
Born and bred, baby!
Born and bred. He went to Bowdoin. He was besties with Nathaniel Hawthorne.
Holy shit.
Like, he is Massachusetts blue blood.
Small world, truly, right?
Yeah, he's besties with Nathaniel Hawthorne. He's besties with Charles Sumner. Like, the Massachusetts elite is a small little inbred group. He's up there with the squad. And Longfellow is very publicly anti-slavery. He's publishing in 1842 poems on slavery, which is his first real support of abolition. Although, this is a direct quote from Longfellow. He wrote, the poems were, quote, so mild that even a slaveholder might read them without losing his appetite for breakfast, unquote.
LOL.
But the New England Anti-Slavery Association liked it, and they reprinted it for further distribution. So he's doing okay.
When was Mark taken down? Because I would imagine, too, if Longfellow's, like, reading this, and... I don't know the poem. I didn't... Immigrant mother. She doesn't give a fuck about Paul Revere. But I imagine when it's like, hear ye, all ye children, gather round. I wouldn't be like, remember when Paul Revere rode by a hanging man? You know what I mean?
Right. Because, I mean, if Longfellow had included that...
That's a bit gruesome, yeah. And not even a bit. Gruesome, period.
Yeah, he's trying to unify the North, the Union, and say, this is America, like... We're doing
okay,
good
childish
things.
Gambino.
Yeah, I know. I was like, yeah, Henry Wadsworth Longfellow is a direct antecedent to Donald Glover's This Is America. Look it up. If Longfellow had brought up Mark in his poem, it would have, you know, shed light on, like, Massachusetts not doing so great.
Yeah, literally, like...
It's not, like, the kind of history... It's history erasure of, like, the truth. Like, we're not trying to point out that, like, there was a landmark in Charlestown where we hung up an enslaved man for decades. That's not a good look. We're trying to inspire...
Definitely not.
Inspire allegiance and unity.
That's a very good point. It doesn't necessarily serve to the purpose of the poem, but if it was such a... Like, I just, from what you've described, it seems so deeply rooted in the public consciousness of the colony that, I don't know, I would assume that it has some sort of lasting effect. And he was like, yeah, I know what that is.
I don't know when his body was removed, but I mean, we know that he hung there for at least a quarter century.
Long enough.
Which is disturbing. I mean, what was 25 years ago? I turned 25 this year. My entire life, he would have been.
Really,
like, Bill Clinton is president and the Lewinsky scandal hasn't broken yet.
That's so funny you mentioned Bill Clinton, just like as an aside, because I woke up this morning and I don't know why I do this, but sometimes I'll wake up and I'll open my phone, I'll go on Safari, and at some point in the middle of the night, I would have gone down a Wikipedia rabbit hole that I have no memory of. Like, I think I do this sleepwalking thing, but instead of walking around, I Wikipedia search people. So I woke up this morning and it was Bill Clinton's Wikipedia page, but not even just like his page. Like, I was deep in it.
Yep.
Have no recollection. I did it with Dolly Parton a few weeks ago, but, you know, we love her.
Friend of the pod.
I reread his Wikipedia page this morning. I was very enthralled.
Yeah. One thing I do in my sleep is make Spotify playlists. And sometimes Spotify playlists. And
that is really funny.
I will add not only songs, but like podcast episodes. So like, I sometimes, this has happened multiple times.
It's like
to me,
an
where
unhinged
I,
playlist.
Uh-huh. And like, not like good ones. Like literally just like my
random
thumbs know where the buttons are for like new playlists and I like put whatever.
That's
so like,
so
I've done this before
funny.
Where I will get in the car and I'll like go find one of my playlists to like click through and like at the top of my playlist, it'll just be like one Maren Morris song and then like an episode of Up First.
That's so funny. I literally imagine it being like Vivaldi Spring. Episode 98 of Insert Here Podcast, and then random Nirvana song.
Right. I'm much more of a Vivaldi's Winter Girl.
Fuck, I am also more of a Vivaldi Winter's Girl.
Oh my god.
Winter Girls Unite.
So as upsetting as the story of Mark is, and as doubly upsetting as it is that it's not really remembered, we do have one point of redemption, and that is because of Paul Revere's account 25 years later, we have a reason why Mark has been brought back into the historical fold. Without Paul Revere's ride, without the Massachusetts Historical Society wanting to commission that report, we probably miss out on mark when it comes to larger historical narratives. Today, there is a marker on that spot, where Mark was hanged. It is across the street from a Royal Pizza and Subs, which is by a Holiday Inn at the edge of the parking lot. This area has previously been referred to as Charlestown Commons, if you're familiar with the area.
It's crazy how stuff like this happens. It's like when Richard III was found under a parking lot.
Uh-huh.
A car park, excuse me.
Yes.
British cousins.
Yeah, and a spot where witches were executed in Salem has recently been discovered by a group of historians because they had, a few records where they mentioned that somebody could see it from the front porch of a house. She could see the top of a hill, and so they essentially looked at old maps of Salem.
Wow,
and looked
that's
at
incredible.
Certain houses and figured out where they were, and then brought in scientists to do readings on the ground to see if there were disturbances, because they would imagine that there'd probably be a shallow grave to put the body in before they were formally buried in unmarked graves.
Yeah.
And that's how they've discovered where the witch burnings at Salem took place, which is why I think it's so important. We are historians in training, but the value of keeping written records pays so many more dividends than we might think at the time. You know, a lot of people keep diaries, a lot of people keep journals and think nothing of it. Oh, it's just my reflections on my life and my day. Maybe so, but it's really evident how much history can be preserved through personal narratives, and I think Mark is a great example of that.
I think Mark also demonstrates really well how history is truly all around us in really hidden ways, especially when it comes to the histories of marginalized communities. Going back to Mark and the whole, being across from a Holiday Inn, what it reminds me of, too, is the stumbling stones in Berlin and other memorials like that, where there has been really horrible history throughout time. I think everybody's very aware of that, but we are also at a point where, as historians, we're constantly uncovering these new histories, not new in the sense that they are currently happening, but new in the sense that they have happened and nobody seems to remember them. So I feel like Mark speaks a lot to that as well.
Absolutely. And so, Sam, it is time for our recurring segment. We've named a lot of names today, but I'd love to hear who you believe is the best of history here and who, of course, is the pest of history.
Okay, let me think for a second.
I'd like to also submit for your consideration that Andrew Jackson was alive during the Life of Henry Wadsworth Longfellow, so he's in play.
Okay, so I have multiple bests. I will say one best of history is Jeremy from the Massachusetts Historical Society. Excuse me, I don't remember the full name of his
Jeremy
whole position.
He was the corresponding secretary.
Okay, well, him. Because it's important to document history.
Facts.
So I would say good on him for being this Paul Revere dude, this might be something someday.
And speaking of the value of archivists, apparently, the Trump administration told the National Archives to, stop recording shit around January 6th.
Oh my God, shut the
so,
fuck
yeah,
up.
So yeah, we're going to put out there, archivists and archives are important.
I will also say a best of history has to be Mark and Phyllis and Phoebe.
Shouts.
Yeah, for obvious reasons. I mean, to live in a time where you're literally treated as nothing is horrible. So I think by default, not knowing who they were as people at all, by default, best of history.
I think for my part, Mark, Phyllis, and Phoebe, I mean, what a crew. To attempt to self-liberate and to be so persistent in doing so when world is set against you, literally people are legislating against your life and your rights.
It's hard to keep going.
It is, but to just think about how this man who was brought down by every system that had been brought into creation in colonial Massachusetts, and nevertheless continued to seek a reunion with his child. A++ for Mark. I love you. It really speaks to the testament of family connection and why that's important for the enslaved community who have been ripped from their families and then ripped from their families again. Just the absolute inhumane condition of the institution of slavery. It's very important that we recall that today.
Well said.
And I would also like to shout out the Horsies.
The Horsies.
I like Horsies, and you're faster.
What a pivot that was.
You're faster than the Redcoats, so A+ to the Horsies.
Big man, little horse.
No horse. I'm not a horse girl. I wanted to say Horsies. And I'd also like to shout out to Boston Rob also, who's not involved in this history, but he could be. I don't know. Call us, friend of the pod, Boston Rob. And Sam, your pest of history for today.
Well, I feel like there's so many. So, pest of history number one, John Convin.
Facts.
Really, like, you any suck. Enslaver? Like,
yeah.
Point blank, period. We had today's episode had a large cast of characters.
Yeah, a lot of criminal behavior. And Preston Brooks, I know you're dead, but I hate you.
I forgot about Preston.
I wish I could.
Touché. I feel like this is gonna haunt me for the next, you know, portion of my life.
Yeah, kind of like it did Charles Sumner.
Oh, Lauren.
Mm. He took one for the team.
I don't think he wanted to.
No, he didn't. He didn't. But he took one, and the team rallied.
I think he took more than one.
Well, he took a lot.
He was made into a complete... I mean, I know he didn't die, but he was made into a complete martyr.
Absolutely.
Right? I think also another pest of history, not a person, but just this idea that the North wasn't and is not today racist, where that's just not true at all. You know, that might have been a conception held during the Civil War, although it's like super prevalent today. Definitely people still believe that the North is not as racist as the South. I think that narrative is so extremely harmful. You can't have any sort of progress when people believe there is no progress to be made. You hear about civil rights marches in Selma, you hear about them in DC, but again, you never hear about them in Boston or in Manhattan or, you know, wherever in this. I'm just picking random two big cities.
Des Moines.
Yeah, Des Moines, that's a good one. That would also be a really big pest of my history for today's episode. A lot of the historical scholarship coming out now, and obviously over the past 40 years, has been challenging that assumption, and I think it needs to continue. It reminds me a lot of Mobilizing Black Germany, Afro-German Women and the Making of a Transnational Movement by Tiffany N. Lorville. A large part of the book is also her reflection of her time in Germany as a Black woman. And I just get the same vibe from that as I do with the whole North and South thing.
Absolutely. And on that poignant note, we have concluded our first 4-episode run of The Rest of History. This podcast was conducted as a project for History and New Media, a graduate level course at American University. You can find all of our information online at therestofhistorypod.weebly.com or on Instagram at therestofhistorypod. Our merch store is open on redbubble.com. Our shop name is Rest of History.
We like to be consistent here at The Rest of History.
Mm-hmm. It's good archival practice.
Yeah, definitely.
Label Look your shit. Us. Tag your shit. Make it easy to find. If you're looking to support the podcast further, please feel free to shoot us a DM. We love to hear from our loyal listeners and our fans.
Our loyalists.
AKA Trevor and the rest of our class. Hey, Trevor, we really enjoyed your class, actually. You know,
was so upset leaving last night.
It hurt our feelings. We really appreciate this entire semester and all of the things we've learned and this opportunity to work together. I know Sam and I have had so much fun making this podcast.
This was a really incredible class, too. I think it really changed my perception of history. Like, yeah, that's corny. Whatever. I'll own it. But it's true. I think it taught me a lot. Yeah. And I had so much fun doing this project with my wonderful co-host, Lauren.
Aww, happy tears.
I know. Happy tears.
As though we're going to, like, not see each other. We live fucking 3 blocks away and we got another year left of this program. Sam's apartment complex is a pool. So I imagine we'll be together quite a lot this summer. But
truly acting like we are both dying.
Oh, man. On this note, if you want to keep up with us personally, you can follow us on Twitter. My username is Lauren_file.
And mine is @SM_Burnett.
And that concludes our 4th episode of The Rest of History. And the rest
is history.